I think if anything, I get sentimentally attached to the time when it was done. So for example, Lewis and Tua, I remember painting that in the Poconos, like after training sessions and before dinner with the team. You know, I'd paint for a little bit, and Emmanuel would come in every day and say, "Oh, this thing's looking great." And it was just that piece to me takes me back to a place in time and memories. And so it's just the fact of when and where it was done. I think that might be the most meaningful piece to me, because I was surrounded by nothing but friends. And it was just a big thing. I knew the gym was struggling, the Frazier gym. I said, maybe we can make like a Kronk / Frazier gym and keep this thing going. And Joe was just against the idea. Emmanuel was for it. And I was kind of stuck in the middle. And Joe said, now I've taught you how to fight. You're going to be like everybody else and leave me, aren't you? Eminem has a piece, Bruno Mars, Travis Tritt, who's a big country western singer over here. He collects. I mean, there's off the top of my head, Donald Trump got a piece when it was his birthday party, and Joe Frazier had to buy him a gift. So Joe said, "Hey, you know, can you do a painting for him?" So that's how the piece got in Trump's hand. And I think Madonna has a piece. Denzel Washington. It's tough to say. My typical answer is, you know, when people say, how long did it take you to paint that? I say 46 years, because that's how long it took me to learn the skills.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
You couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
I said, he's bitten me. He said, well, let's bully him back.
And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
There's winning, and there's nothing else.
Hello, welcome to this week's podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. Really appreciate the feedback on the Nicky Piper interview last week. If you haven't checked it out, please go back and look at it. This week, I'm delighted to say I'm joined by the first artist that I've interviewed for Boxing Life Stories, and it's none other than the brilliant Richard Sloan. Richard is now based out of Las Vegas. He's from England originally, and as you'll hear through this story, he spent long spells in Philadelphia with Joe Frazier at Joe's gym, and then at the Kronk in Detroit living with Emmanuel Steward. He talks here about his journey through boxing and through art and how he's combined the two. You will recognize his paintings, I'm sure, from various fight posters and fight promotions. He does the Hall of Fame covers. He's done numerous magazine covers for Boxing News and for Ring Magazine over the years. He's a great talker, got loads of great stories, loves to puff on a cigar once in a while. We did this interview on Sunday. I really hope you guys enjoy it. Like I said, it's the first artist. I'm well up for speaking to more boxing artists. They have fascinating backgrounds, and I really enjoyed this with Richard. Very pleased that he's the first one, because his work means a lot to me. Some of you will know that I write biographies for the International Boxing Hall of Fame program, so it's always a privilege and a pleasure to see my work alongside his. Same thing in Ring Magazine. Some of the stuff that I've done recently, he's painted cover story the covers for the cover stories that I've written. So it's always good to do that. And I do really like hearing Richard talk about those great days he spent with Frazier and with Emmanuel Steward and so forth. Before we get going, I do want to say thank you to my sponsors, Blaz at Hanson Lee Resourcing and Derek at Delco Safety Compliance. Hanson Lee Resourcing were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the 2020 Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hanson Lee find you the best people, but they can help you retain them. And you can find out more about them at hansonlee.com. Delco Safety Compliance are a leading provider of professional fire, asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. And they offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. I'm also getting a few people asking about Patreon that I've been mentioning on the recent podcasts. And Patreon's basically it's a website for creators, for content creators, and you can put up more content and people subscribe to your content. So on my Patreon page at the moment, I'm putting up behind the scenes access to Boxing Life story stuff. They're getting early access to the episodes that I do. So this Richard Sloan one's already been up there a couple of days. I'm also doing polls and audio and smaller podcasts up there. So recently I had a podcast, I had a poll where Patreons chose between whether they wanted to hear about the Manny Pacquiao fights I covered in person or why I left Boxing News. At the moment, there's the poll up there is the Carl Froch fights I covered and my relationship with Froch up against the reality versus the dream of being Boxing News editor. So there's all kinds of stuff going on in terms of insight into my 20, 25 years in boxing journalism that goes up there. My research goes up there. So there's a lot of behind the scenes access and content up there. Is a way of you guys also supporting the podcast and helping me take it to the next level with different things I want to do and different things I want to achieve with the podcast. So you can check that out at www.patreon.com/TrisDixon. And I will leave you now with the brilliant Richard Sloan.
So Richard, it's great to get you on. One thing that struck me recently, I did mention this to you the other day as well, was, you know, when I hear about an artist, you kind of have this idyllic image of someone painting overlooking the sea in a very sort of tranquil setting and very peaceful. And you're sort of doing, you're doing it at your own pace. And then you mentioned to me about being on deadline to finish some work. And then Geraldine, who represents you over here in the UK, she actually said that you fell asleep at the easel the other day. So, I mean, it's not all, I've got the wrong end of the stick here in terms of how you work, haven't I?
You have, Tris. It's pretty, pretty controlled by the deadlines of publications and things like that. And then, you know, you have to get it scanned afterwards and color corrected. There's a lot to it. And, the idea of sitting on a beach, painting at my leisure, smoking cigars and sipping whiskey is wonderful, but that's not the way it really goes. It's like most other people's jobs. It looks great from the outside, but you have to really hustle.
Do you paint for pleasure and for leisure, or do you just paint for work now?
Well, I've never worked a day in my life. That's the way I look at it, because, you know, painting really is my pleasure. And sometimes I procrastinate a little bit and it throws me off kilter. Then when I paint, I realize, you know what, it's my medicine. It's my grounding point. And I love painting. So it really is very pleasurable.
Do you have your own pictures up in your own house?
I have a few, not many. I'm actually looking now. I have a big portrait of Emmanuel Stewart that's actually a photograph that we shot in Big Bear. And I have other stuff, some family photos and mainly fight posters. I have like some Ali Frazier fight posters, things like that. There's a couple of paintings around, but my house is my studio. So it's, it's not like I decorate in any specific way. It's the house of a madman, an artist.
And you're in Vegas?
I'm in Las Vegas. I'm actually in the olden area of Vegas called Paradise Palms, which a lot of celebrities lived in this neighborhood. It's very old now. It went down to a cheap rent district. But I'm within walking distance from the house where Sonny Liston died. It's actually maybe 15 houses from me. Max Baer Jr., who I believe is still alive, he played Jethro in the Hillbillies, Beverly Hill Hillbillies, or whatever it was. And he owns some property on the corner. And the golf course that was featured in Casino, the movie, is the golf course right here. And that's where the Rat Pack used to hang out. So I'm in vintage Vegas.
When did you move to Vegas?
2010.
Okay, so
permanently.
That golf course you mentioned, wasn't Sonny's apartment near a golf course for a while, or was that
that's exactly
yeah
Yeah, that's exactly it. The back of his house is actually on the golf course. It's now called the National Golf Course, but I believe at one time it was either the Stardust or Sands, and that's the clubhouse. I mean, it's been there since the 50s, and the clubhouse, it was the number one golf course. And the clubhouse would have Sammy Davis and Dean Martin and Sinatra in there hanging out. And when you go in there, they'll tell you this is where they used to sit. And it's still a very historic place. And next time you come to Vegas, man, we'll check it out. It's a great neighborhood. Joe Louis lived when he was doing his greeting at Caesar's Palace. His house is in a little cul-de-sac. Again, two blocks from me. Oh, it seemed like so many fighters. And then the guy that they featured, Ace Rothstein from the movie Casino, his house is on the corner. So it's real vintage Vegas, man. They got deep swimming pools and hidden safes in these houses. It's like the stories these houses could probably tell. It would be amazing.
Well, you mentioned the Stardust. That was the first hotel I ever stayed in Vegas. Wayne Newton was in there, and obviously that's since been destroyed, isn't it?
It has, yeah. Wow, I never stayed there, but it's certainly one of the most. When I speak to the old timers here, that everybody loved the Stardust.
Yeah, it was iconic, wasn't it? It was.
Absolutely.
It's right up by where the Fashion Show Mall is now, isn't it?
It's opposite the Pepper Mill. It's just a little bit north of the Fashion Show Mall, and they're actually building a new casino there called Resorts Worlds. That's almost finished. They've worked through this whole COVID thing. And that's going to be the next big release here in Vegas, Resorts World. And, they're hoping to kind of bridge that gap between the south end of the strip, which is MGM and all the fight hotels, and the downtown. They're trying to fill in that little bit of a gap there, which where the Stardust was.
Which goes further up to Johnny Tacos and so forth up that way.
Exactly.
And you mentioned Peppermill. That's where I went for breakfast with Eddie Mustafa a few months ago.
Really? Wow. Yeah, that's also iconic. In the back is Elvis Presley's private little booth where he'd perform at the Hilton, and he'd come over there. And they said it hasn't changed at all. The only thing that's changed is the seats have been reupholstered in the exact same velvet. But if you go all the way to the back, it's Elvis's little booth. And they said he'd sneak in the back door and nobody would even know he was there.
Brilliant. Well, that's where I did have breakfast with Eddie, so maybe I did sit in an Elvis seat. It would be great.
That's right.
So our listeners who are tuning in might not be able to pick the twang in your voice. You don't sound wholly like a US resident, if you excuse me for saying that, because your journey started in the UK, didn't it? You were from the UK.
It did, and I've been accused of being from everywhere, from the West Indies to Boston to you name it, Australia, I get a lot. But yeah, my journey did start. I was born and raised in Cumbria, in Barrow-in-Furness area, a little village just outside of Barrow, which is a shipbuilding community. And at age six, I boxed for the Barrow Amateur Boxing Club, and I was a big fight fan, and I befriended Joe Frazier. And when he came to London in 1989 to promote Champions Forever, along with Ali and Foreman and Kenny Norton. I don't think Kenny made it to England, but Ali and George did. And
yeah, that would have been around the time of his car crash, wasn't it? Late 80s.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, in California. Yeah. So when Joe and Ali and Foreman were here, I got a hold of Burt Watson, who is more famous for his UFC involvement these days. But Burt was representing Joe. And I said, I'd like to come down, meet him. And he said, well, it's very busy. And I said, well, I'm going to head to London on the train, and I'm going to train at Thomas Abeki gym and about whatever it takes. If it's 3 o'clock in the morning, if he'll just take a look at me and I'd just love to meet him. And he did. He stopped by the gym and he liked what he saw, and we got along really well. Of course, I knew his history very well. Because I'd loved boxing since I was a child. And they said, if you finish school, come to Philly and you can box. I said, well, can't I just quit school and come now? He said, no, you gotta finish. So I was, 16 when I finished school, and 2 months later, I was on that plane with $40 in my pocket in one pocket, and the other pocket was full of dreams.
And you and I have some similarities along here, in the sense that you sort of seem to be able and willing to mix with these big names, even when you were nothing and brought nothing to the table. And you somehow developed these relationships, and it's something I can relate to, with people across the pond, when it was just staying in touch with people on the phone.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what it comes down to with boxing, unlike many other professions that have been around, you know, I'm a boxing guy. It's in my blood, and I think there's a certain amount of authenticity that us guys, you included, and these fighters, you know, we just kind of get that bond, man. And you know, it doesn't matter if you're a champion of the world or if you're working, carrying the spit buckets and mopping the gym. It's like, you know, everybody is acceptable. And I think that's the only sport and the only entertainment, let's say, that would really happen. I mean, these guys are making millions of dollars, but they're still regular guys. They will return a phone call. They will take time out of the day. I mean, obviously, they're human. They do have bad days, but we've been very lucky to be bit by this boxing bug, and it's well reciprocated by the superstars.
Were your parents into boxing at all?
Yes. My grandfather was the British boxing champion for the army, and he was really based, I think, in India, perhaps World War II. I'm trying to get some more photographs, but my father was he was a bouncer and blacksmith, and did the boxing stuff, but he liked to have the crack, as they say in England and Ireland. He liked to, you know, go out on the weekends and live life up. So boxing wasn't really cut for him, but he trained and, like I said, worked at the door. He liked the nightlife and the hard living and hard working, blacksmith.
And you did the doors for a while too.
Farrier, shoot horses. I did as a young kid. I mean, paved by my brother John, my older brother, and my father, John Senior. These guys had a pretty good reputation, so I snuck in on their coattail. You know, I didn't really have to earn my way in like many of the doormen. I was. They were like, hey, if he's one of the Sloans, he must be able to fight a little bit too. So I caught a pass there. I had to prove myself only once or twice.
At what point did the art come into it?
Art's always been there. I remember winning a school award. We had to decorate a hat. It was some little competition in arts class when I was maybe, I guess it was right around the time when Rocky came out. So if that was 70, I think maybe Rocky 2 or 3, maybe like 78, I was 4 years old, and I created the hat in a Rocky Balboa theme. And okay. On the top of the hat was I used pipe cleaners for the ring ropes. And that was my first like accomplishment in boxing art, so to say. And ever since then, it's just been solely boxing. Like people have, I have painted a few other subjects, but very rarely. Like my heart's never in it. Leroy Neiman told me, you know, you could never make a living as a boxing artist. You know, kid, you're crazy. And I said, well, it's not the first time I've been called crazy, and I'm sure it's not the last.
So back. So at the start, what were the things? Obviously, you mentioned the Rocky theme and stuff. Do you remember who the first fighter was that you painted?
I think it was for my art classes in Dowdale School, which you know, I've been gone so long. I guess, you know, senior school in England, over here they call it high school, and I did a series of boxing paintings for my art finals, and I did Hagler Mugabe, and I think I did Holmes and Norton, and they were quite large paintings. And before I even got the results of my school tests, I was already on the plane and gone. So to this day, I don't know the scores of any of my school results.
Did you have the same style, though? Those, the Mugabe, Hagler ones and so forth, were they a similar style to what you do now?
Similar style, actually, yeah. I look back and I see certain characteristics, even from the oldest piece of artwork that I own, was from when I was 3 years old, and I can actually see in there like similar style patterns and lines. It was a drawing of Elvis Presley from 77. I guess it's the year he died, and it was a big thing. And I look back, and my style is always developing. But there's, you know, there's always those anchors there that you can recognize if you really look. And a lot of the times, I'll hide stuff in paintings that people have no idea until they look, and I show them. And it could be a word, it could be somebody else's face hidden in there, like a meaningful face of some sort. And you know, it's known to very few people, but I do, you know, there's a lot goes into the paintings. There's a lot more than what you just see when you look.
Can you give me an example of something that you've smuggled into one of your pictures?
Okay, since my father passed away in May, and as a tribute to him, if you look at the Hatton Malignaggi fight poster and program and everything that was done, in the back there's a real faint ghostly referee. You can see his hand and his shirt very, very well, but it's actually my father's face who's the referee, and it's very vague. It's very hard to see, but when you look, you can definitely capture it. It's like right between the arms, and you don't think there's a referee in the painting, but if you actually look, there's just a smoked out like referee in the background.
That's brilliant. So the boxing bug bit you. Was it quite all consuming then? You weren't into any other thing? It was boxing that you wanted to be involved with?
It was the only thing I wanted to do. I mean, it wasn't boxing art. I actually used to hate when Joe Frazier used to tell me, you know, this kid's a great artist. Like, he'd introduce people and say, hey, he's a great artist. It really bothered me because I wanted him to say he's a great fighter. And so I really put a muffler on the art career and, you know, tried to really remain humble about it and not show too many people. I would you know, kind of hide my sketchbooks and just do it at the gym. We didn't have any TV. We didn't even have any hot water back then. In the early 90s, we lived pretty hard in North Philly, which you're aware of that neighborhood. And one day, Ring Magazine walked in, and I think it was 96. David Gerhardt was the managing director. He was coming to pick up an ad or do something for Joe. And Joe was late, and we got to talking, and he said, you know, what's his book here? He said, are you writing? I said, no, I'm a fighter. You know, again, everybody, I just didn't want to be known as an artist. And I said, I don't write at all. He's like, oh, because, you know, if you write, we can maybe get you in the magazine. And the light bulb went off, and I said, well, maybe I should show this guy my drawings. And a month later, I was doing the Oscar De La Hoya and Chavez cover for Boxing 96.
Oh, wow. Okay. And was that your first cover?
That was my first cover. Yep. And at that time, obviously, London Publishing owned KO, Boxing 96, 97, so on, and Ring Magazine. So they had, you know, like five monthly magazines, and I've pretty much been published in all of them.
Do you know how many covers you've done total now?
I don't. I don't even know. Somebody just told me the other day, just Vegas fights at the MGM, I've done 35 actual official fight posters for the MGM. So I have no idea how many covers I've done for magazines. And I have no idea how many artworks are out there.
I just want to flashback. I never kept count. You said about Joe and how you guys met up in London. But also, while you were in the UK, before you left for the US, you were running up extortionate phone bills, phoning people like Emmanuel Stewart and Bob Arum and stuff. Like, what did you want out of the phone calls? Were you trying to get them to take a look at you as a fighter and all the rest of it?
Yeah, a little bit. And they also, I mean, Emmanuel would, I mean, I'd have to make a lot of these calls from the phone box, you know, the loaded up with you know, pound
phone cards, put credit on the phone cards and all the rest of it.
This might have been before the phone cards, it was bags full of change and 50 pence pieces and all that stuff, and I'd call from there, and eventually Emmanuel would always accept return call, like collect calls, and the same with the Petronelli brothers. Pat specifically became very friendly, and they'd use me to scout English fighters and things like that, and send VHS tapes. I had a big collection of tapes, and you know, Bob Arum once called me and asked what I thought of Nigel Benn, and I said he's no, you know, this time I was so pro Marvin Hagler, and Tommy Hearns. I was never, I don't want to hurt Ray's feelings, but Hagler and Hearns were you know my Maybe favorites of the yeah of the four aces. And so Aram said, you know, what do you think of this kid, Ben? And Ben was making massive headlines because he was, I think at the time, maybe 18-0 with like 18 knockouts, the Dark Destroyer. And I said, oh, he'd last three rounds with Hagler at most. And I don't think much of him. And because I was just so defensive of Marvin. And I was selling Marvin's merchandise in England too. So anyway, Bob ended up going against my my advice. And he signed Ben, and Ben knocked out Barkley, and you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, of course.
But I did a lot of stuff with Emmanuel also in England. Like I said, they would use me as the English liaison. Let's say I worked the corners when Gerald McClellan knocked out Mugabe for the WBO belt. I carried the belt into the ring for Gabby Canizales when he fought Duke McKenzie. And here I am from Cumbria, and everybody's shouting, yo, Yank, get out of here. You know what I mean? Like, you guys are going to get your ass kicked tonight. And I'm thinking, I'm English too, but I'm carrying in Gabby Canizales' belt, you know. And it was funny. And, yeah, Dennis Andres and Harding, I worked that corner with Emmanuel. And I think that was the third fight at the Hammersmith Odeon. Majority decision in Harding's favor.
So when you mentioned obviously that first magazine cover, was that where your career pivoted from being in the gyms to being an artist?
Yeah, it really did. I wanted Emmanuel and Joe to work together with me. I have so much loyalty to Joe. I said, you know, is there any way? Because at the time, during 96, 97, I started going to camp with Emmanuel and Lennox Lewis. And I was really enjoying that. And you know, it was just, it was a lot of fun. It was exhilarating. It was, for a guy with a boxing bug, it was as good as it got. You know, as was hanging with Joe. But I said, is there any way, you know, you can come up here and maybe, you know, it's 2 hours away from Philadelphia. I said, can you come up and, you know, hang with Lennox a little bit? Maybe there's opportunity. I knew the gym was struggling, the Frazier gym. I said, maybe we can make like a Kronk / Frazier gym and keep this thing going. And, you know, Joe was just against the idea. Emmanuel was for it. And I was kind of stuck in the middle. And Joe said, now I've taught you how to fight. You're going to be like everybody else and leave me, aren't you? And at that point, I shook his hand and I said, I will not fight for anybody else if you're not involved. So after that, my desire just seemed to slowly dissipate, and I just focused on artwork and helping Emmanuel, you know, get sparring partners, all the guys I knew from Philadelphia. It was an easy ride to Lennox's camp.
Because you've been around those heavyweights. You'd sparred people like David Bay and Witherspoon and Tex Cobb, lots of guys that have been around Philly.
Exactly. Because I was from England and I had a real tough time getting the amateur stuff, we had one guy that was like dead against me. He was involved with USA Boxing and he knew my status of being a British national. So he wouldn't let me box in any tournaments that would lead to any regionals or you know, anything that eventually could end up at the top of the mountain, which would be, you know, the Olympic team. So he kind of put a stop to any amateur stuff I could do. So I do exhibitions and Tex, Bert Cooper, Tim Witherspoon, David Bay. We had Booker T. Word for a while. It was just a little short fire plug and the list goes on.
Didn't he end up fighting Michael Nunn?
I don't know if it was Michael Nunn. I know he knocked out Anthony Hembrick. That was his big thing. He might have fought none, but we got him, and I think he lost the fight when he trained for Frazier. I'm not 100% sure, but he was a real funny guy. I haven't heard from him in years. I know he's based in Michigan somewhere, and while I was in Michigan, I thought maybe I'd run into him on the boxing scene, but I never did.
Do you have any crazy Bert Cooper stories? Because he has some crazy stories.
Oh, man. Bert was unfortunately, you know, he had the demons of of addiction, but he was, to me, anybody I ever sparred, he was certainly the hardest hitter. That little right hand, like a chopping right hand that he had, there was like no way to get away from it. He would move himself into position. This guy was so strong, he would move himself into position. And if he just, and Joe always told him to go easy on him. Joe knew I couldn't handle Bert Cooper. So, you know, he said, go easy on the kid. But every once in a while, Bert would drop that little right hand or dig one of them hooks. I was never knocked down in my fight career, but if anybody rung my bell with the high pitched sound, it was certainly Bert Cooper. And then he'd get out the ring, and it would just be all laughs. He had the ability to make everybody laugh. Like I said, I don't know the darkness or demons that he had to carry himself.
You never had a night out with Bert.
You did?
No, did you? Did you ever?
No, I never had a night out with him because Joe kept that apart. You know, there was quite a few instances with Joe, and at one point, it's public knowledge that Joe Jr. got in some trouble with the drugs and stuff like that. So Joe really tried to keep me away from socializing with those guys, but the gym was the gym, but Bert always had a joke. He always had a prank on somebody, and it was always innocent, but funny as hell. He's one of the funniest people I've ever been around.
Yeah, because I mean, I went and saw Bert near his home in Derby in Pennsylvania a few years ago.
Right.
We were in touch. In fact, just before his death, I think I last interviewed him last year. He'd gone up to the Hall of Fame, and Bert had all these stories where he would obviously go out for days on end just before a fight, and then he'd show up just in time for the fight, and he'd been on drugs for the whole week.
Yeah.
There's that one story about the George Foreman fight where he was in great shape for Foreman, and then two days before he was due to fight Foreman, someone said to prostitutes around to his bedroom. And he didn't sleep for the next 2 days, and that was that.
Exactly. That's the story I heard, and I heard they followed him on the elevator, and by the time they all got off the elevator, they were heading to Bert's room. So, and his legs were gone come fight night.
Bert had some great stories. So your early dealings with Emmanuel, were they based on him being in the Poconos and over on the East Coast as opposed to you being in Detroit?
No, actually, my first dealings was doing stuff in England for him.
When it's opening the Cronks and Pancras?
No, it was way before that. I think the first fight we did together, I helped him. It was because, obviously I'm a northerner in England, northwest, and he had a fight in Leeds. Leon Zababa fought Tom Collins at the Leeds Town Hall. And he had a couple of undercard kids. Todd Riggs was one, a real tall, white welterweight. So I was kind of their guide, they didn't know the lingo to buy stuff. And I was just like their local guy, even though I personally didn't know Leeds so well. So ever since then, I kept in good contact with Emmanuel and actually with Leon Zababa for a while. And Todd Riggs to this day, he's still training fighters, amateurs. We stayed in contact. And then once he found out I was in Philadelphia, Peter Goldfield, who was his photographer, said, you know what, that little chubby kid that used to show us around Leeds is no longer chubby. I watched him box Tim Witherspoon or something, and he held his own, and you should maybe take a look at this guy. And so Emmanuel invited me to Detroit, and I did some training there at the Kronk gym and got to know everybody. And then that's when it led to going back to Joe saying, hey Joe, can't we collaborate here? I'll have an all-star corner between Emmanuel and Joe Frazier. It's like, it would have been ideal to me, but Joe was just against the idea, and he gave me my start, so I just couldn't break my word.
So how many fights did you have in all?
Because of this guy with the blocking me for the amateur stuff, I didn't have any, even though I had a USA book, there was no all the fights kind of led to some kind of tournament. So officially there was no amateur fights. It was just exhibitions. Yeah. Although I did fight, and again, it was an exhibition. It wasn't ruled by the USA Boxing, but I think it was 94 or 95, Frazier's team fought Holyfield's team. I fought on that card. That was in Atlanta. That was a fun event.
With regards to Joe, he could be quite a surly character at times, couldn't he?
He could until he really trusted you. At first, he didn't trust me, and I got along better with Marvis. But after like 3 months, Joe and I were inseparable. It's like he knew I had his back 110%. But he was untrusting, and rightfully so. There were so many people that did take advantage of him financially. You know, he should have been set for life. The property deal he had went bad. He got ripped off. He would never had any issues whatsoever had he not been ripped off. And
that was buying the land around where he was brought up, wasn't it?
No, it was actually, obviously he was brought up in Beaufort, South Carolina, but this was land just outside of Philadelphia.
And
he bought it for $840,000 when he was champ, and it was just like a wooded area. And today it's worth $100 million, and he never ever transferred over the rights. Some lawyers did it, and he says it was a fraudulent signature. He's proven that he never got any payment. He had proven he's obviously gone now, but they fought and fought for it, and they didn't win the case in the end. And Joe had burned that money, which when he spent it was a lot of money, and he would have been set for life if that thing didn't get screwed up.
I heard Marvis is up Boston way now. Is that right? Do you know that?
I believe he's. Last time I talked to Marv, I meant to call him a few days ago for his birthday, but he was in Georgia with his daughter and grandchildren. It's funny. He's in a place called Beaufort, Georgia, and Marv and Joe are from Beaufort, South Carolina. So he's back to Beaufort.
How's Marvis doing now? Do you know?
Yeah, he's doing well. I mean, he's getting up in age, he's content with his career. He's losing to Tyson and Holmes as a pro is nothing to be ashamed of. And people seem to make fun of him a little bit because of those fights, but he's. Very proud of his career and very proud of his family, and he's just keeping the weight off, he said, and running on the treadmill, volunteering his time with kids and taking care of his grandkids.
And so at what point did you up sticks and move to Detroit?
Really, once I got to the Lennox Lewis camp, which was about 96, I got to Frazier in 1990. So after like 6 or 7 years, I was thick with the Crump team, and it was a more exciting ride. They had way more fighters, and I was helping bring in sparring partners and making some fights and some undercards, and living with Emmanuel. So eating at great restaurants, hanging out, just having a blast, and that all happened about 97. And then I stayed with Emmanuel until I'd say 94. After Lennox retired, I was around for a year or so afterwards. That was living in his house for 7 years. And then after that, I had my own place and started looking at my own stuff, maybe start managing some fighters on my own. I got involved with Vivian Harris. A couple of other young guys, and started doing a little bit of matchmaking. Just kind of trying to find my legs without a boxing career as a fighter. And the one thing that was a constant, and I could make a couple of dollars, that was the artwork. So then I started focusing, more on art. I'd been doing the Hall of Fame covers since 96. It's funny, I didn't get the paint Emmanuel, and he was really upset that Emmanuel liked to be captured correctly. He didn't like any bad photographs of himself. He didn't like any, he was quite vain, and he was a great, great brander, as we know, with the Kronk gym. So he knew how to market things, including himself. And he hated the 1996 program cover of him. And he was like, man, he was like, yeah, I didn't paint it. I painted the 97 one, but I got hired in 96. And they said, next year you'll be doing it. And but I did paint Emmanuel for his living room, and he was very happy with it.
So you obviously talk about the Kronk brandy and marketing. You got roped into doing some of the stuff on the Kronk website, didn't you?
I did. I actually founded the Kronk website in camp. This was, we had to get a special connection, and it was dial-up at the time, AOL, and we started KronkGym.com, I believe, in 98. And at one time, we were training Lennox and Naz, and we were doing daily updates, including some video footage, and we were the number three boxing website out there, I think Fight News and Boxing Press or Seconds Out. I think it was Boxing Press at that time. But we were right up there. We were getting lots and lots of traffic because of the exclusives with Lennox and Naz.
And you've written basically Emmanuel's life story up there, haven't you?
I did. Yeah. That's actually, you know, Emmanuel doesn't get credit on that, but that's, you know, I just kind of took the notes. I'm not a very good writer. And, As an ace writer, I'm sure you look at it and think, man, what is this crap? I can give it, you know, but the facts are there, and it's like
no, it's great. It's a really long piece, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's how Emmanuel was. Like he wanted to put everything in, and he got down to dates, and you know, some of it's quite repetitive, but you know, I vividly remember the you know, the times we'd spent sat there over the dining table in the Poconos writing that and compiling photographs. And I still have a lot of those photographs scanned and things like that. So, you know, if ever Tris Dixon does a Kronk book, we got all the artillery we need.
Did Lennox ever rope you into sparring?
Never. You know, I don't think Lennox looked at me really as a fighter. Because at that time, you know, I was just bringing in sparring partners and doing the computer stuff. These guys didn't really know I was an artist and didn't really know much about me. I didn't want to interfere with anything they had going. I was a new guy in the camp, obviously not forever, but that first year set the precedence, and they just looked at me as Emmanuel's right-hand man.
Was Tommy Hearns about much at all?
Absolutely, yeah. Tommy would come to the camps. I actually did the matchmaking for, and it's really, I guess, nothing to be too proud of, because the fight stunk with Nate Miller, and it was Tommy's first appearance, I believe, as a pro in England, and yeah, we needed a last minute opponent. He was supposed to fight Darren Corbett, and that fight fell out. And last minute, and I knew Nate Miller from Philly, so I said, you know, let's get a hold of Nate and see if he'll do the fight. And unfortunately, they put it on after the Naz fight, and people, you know, people started walking out and booing. It just was a dud of a fight. But Tommy did regain the IBO championship, which it's nice to say I made a match that Tommy won a belt, you know.
What did Emmanuel make of Tommy's health and sort of how it declined after boxing? Was that something he ever spoke about?
Yeah, he just, you know, Thomas was and some of Tommy's brothers talk the same. They they've never had really had the fights or the careers that Tommy had had. You know, Emmanuel would tell him, and I learned from this too, that, you know, take the time to try to pronounce things right. I have a terrible habit of slurring and doing things, and I know it's not from boxing. And with Thomas, you know, Emmanuel would always say, like, you know, perk yourself up, drink some coffee, you're going to be on TV, and you know, think about the words before you speak them, because Tommy would. So I don't think Tommy's in any kind of bad shape. I think it's just he has to be reminded that he does have no breathing through his nose, and that makes him, you know, harder to talk. And you know, when he's sharp, he's sharp, but just the tone of his voice and The fact he can't breathe through his nose makes it sound a hell of a lot worse than I think it really is.
Who else was around at the time? Obviously, you mentioned Lennox. Who else was in the? Who else was around the Kronk around the time that you were, around?
Yeah, we had all the Kronk fighters and all the great Kronk trainers. I mean, the you know, Kronk was obviously, Manuel was the captain, but behind Emmanuel, he had a great team of trainers like Luther Burgess, who had been around for years and fought Willie Pep as a pro, and Luther knew the game inside out. Mr. Walter Smith, he fought along with Joe Lewis, who was one of Joe Lewis's right-hand men, and Floyd Logan. I mean, there was like 15 good trainers there, so they were often in the camps with Lennox. And all the great fighters that had been in the Kronk since they were 5 years old, guys that never really made the mainstream, like Marlon Thomas, and I mean, there's just a massive list of guys that were always there. Cardi King, Pierre Caram, there were so many really, really talented fighters, but just they never became household names. But they could, you know, spar with anybody. I mean, Marlon Thomas and Oscar De La Hoya used to go toe-to-toe in the gym, and it was better than any, or as good as any pro fight you would see.
What happened to Octavio Lara? I remember Emmanuel was so high.
Yeah.
I think he took him to the Hall of Fame 1 year, and also I saw him work with Lara. I think Lennox was in camp for Kirk Johnson at the time, but obviously he wound up fighting Vitali. And Manuel would swear by Lara and say he was the next big thing.
Yeah, Octavio had all the talent and things like that, but his father brought him to the gym since he was really young. And Octavio was a very, very tough fighter, tough Mexican style. He idolized Chavez, but as he grew into a man, he got a girlfriend, and one time he wanted to go to law school, and I remember Egerton Marcus, who was always in camp with Lennox, one of Lennox's best friends, telling Octavio, if you become a world championship boxer, you don't have to worry about a lawyer. He was like, you can just hire the best lawyers you want. He was like, don't. He was like, but if you're a lawyer, you'll never be a world champion. So, but Octavio just started losing the love for the game. And I can understand that. You know, it is a love affair, and like all love affairs, you can fall out of love and still admire the sport. But if your heart's not fully in it, then you know. And it got to the point where Octavio's heart wasn't really in it anymore.
Yeah.
And he wanted to go to school, so Emmanuel helped him out with his college fees, and he wanted to learn some mechanic stuff, I believe. And he just didn't really want it.
Yeah. Tell me, you know, obviously you said about living with Emmanuel and stuff. What was it like to almost, if you don't mind me using this phrase, ride Emmanuel's coattails around Detroit with the brand and how big he was? Obviously people say that the Kronk was produced more champions than four produced cars up there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, the little hangouts that Emmanuel would have, and Emmanuel would get along with everybody. You'd be so surprised. He could be rubbing shoulders with the mayor 1 minute, and then an hour later he could be in some little speakeasy on the east side of Detroit, and you know, with all these gangsters and you know, everybody was wearing the pimp suits with the lime green shoes. It's Emmanuel fitting with everybody, and I'd never seen him have any problem there. He was so respected. He was so kind. He would often go to the farmer's market to get fresh fruits. As many people know, he was an avid cook, and he had his own garden too. He would you know, make his own tomatoes and different things. But whenever we were at the farmer's market and he was buying groceries, it was his thing to always pay for the person in front of him. So whoever got in front of him was lucky. He'd usually go Sunday mornings or whenever he got right back in town, before he even hit home, he'd say, let's go to the market. And no matter how much food they had in front, he'd just say, put that bill on mine. You know, it was great because, you know, some of these people were obviously like single mothers, things like that. It was great watching how he operated.
Yeah, of course. And he did. Were you a part of any of these famous cookouts that he had, where he'd put a cookout on and basically jump on the neighbor to come around?
Absolutely. I think the most pissed off Emmanuel ever got with me was he was doing this big barbecue, this big thing, and he was very serious about his barbecuing. And there was a guy called Ron Gerard, who was a photographer and journalist. And Ron was in town to cover Emmanuel with something. And Ron said to me, "Man, I'm starving, man." He was like, "How the hell long is it going to be before Emmanuel gets this thing done?" I said, "I don't know. I'm hungry too." So Emmanuel said, "Oh man," he said, "I need some vinegar." He said, "You got to go get this apple cider vinegar." And he had a spray bottle he used to put it in and spray it on these ribs and stuff. So we thought, "Oh, this is great. This is our out. Now we can run to the store, get the vinegar, and get a quick McDonald's or something in, or a Snickers bar or something." So we went to Boston Market, which is a chicken place over here, and we got his vinegar, and then we said, "We can't be long in here." So we ran in and got like a couple of pieces of chicken because we were starving. And one of Emmanuel's girlfriends saw us in there, and she called Emmanuel and said, "Hey, I just saw Richard. He's in town." And he said, "Oh, where at the grocery store?" She said, "No, he's eating food at the Boston Market." So when we got back, then me and Ron Gerard, we got a real grilling. He said, "I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on here," but he said, "UMFers," he was like, "I go through all this trouble for this, and you got no discipline." I mean, he was hot.
Were you around Emmanuel at all when his health started to falter, or were you gone in Vegas by then?
I was already in Vegas, but I'd see him when he would come to Vegas, and we'd talk very often. And I'd also talk to his assistant, who was really like a sister to him, Lainey Perry. And then I knew some people in Chicago where he was. He was at the American Cancer Center in Chicago, and I was getting updates from there. I knew he wasn't good at one point. I said, "Emmanuel, I want to come up there." And he said, "No, please stay where you're at." He said, "But just pray for me." He said, just say a prayer." And it happened so fast, it just happened so fast. It was real sad. And I kind of knew maybe 2 weeks before, because even though I was here, we'd always talk about business. And we're gonna, get this camp going, and you can join this camp and come here. And he was always very optimistic about everything. And about 2 weeks before, the conversation really had nothing to do with boxing. The optimism was gone, and I just kind of hung up the phone. I was like, "Wow!" I was like, "This is, this is a new Emmanuel. I've never, in my 30-year relationship with him, I've never known this to be like this."
How come you moved from Detroit to Vegas? How did that come about?
It was, I was doing artwork here, and I just figured this would be the place to be. Emmanuel had some people here, and I came to help them. And I started flying into all the big fights, and the money I was spending on flights, I thought, I can get a little apartment there. And I was, initially when I got here, I had a roommate, and it was cheaper to stay here than to keep coming back. With all the gyms, we trained Lennox here for a few fights. Actually, the April when Naz lost and Lennox lost in South Africa, we were based in Vegas, and Emmanuel and I had to fly every day to Palm Springs to train Naz, which was a nightmare, but. And Emmanuel loved Vegas, a lot of connections, and I just thought it's better for me to be based there, for everybody.
Why was Naz, why was that a nightmare? Was it because he was sort of running his own show by then?
That's exactly right. I'm sure you've heard Naz was running his own show, and
we've seen the documentary as well.
Yeah. And there's, I'm glad Emmanuel was so open in the documentary, because that's how he felt. And Naz is one of my favorite people, one of my favorite fighters. We've FaceTimed a few times in the last year or so. But he just, he liked that high life there. They made a decision to train in Palm Springs for some reason. And they rented out Bing Crosby's house, turned Bing Crosby's garage into a boxing gym. and getting sparring partners in and out wasn't easy. Getting Emmanuel there wasn't easy. We had to take a single propeller jet plane, actually not a jet plane, but a private plane, and we'd fly in and spend a couple of hours. Emmanuel was never really impressed with what he saw. He said, he needs to bring his ass to Vegas and train alongside Lennox.
Yeah. The Vegas thing, I mean, have you ever had your own gallery or shop there, or has it just been you work for clients and that you get asked to do the paintings?
I have some guys that have had shops, like the Fight Museum in the Mandalay Bay, which is no longer in business, but they carried my stuff for many years. And I'll let certain galleries do carry my artwork, but not many. I don't produce that much work that I need a gallery. So and most of my originals are spoken for before they're even finished. It's either a commission or a consignment from promoter, fighter. So, I mean, other than prints, there's really no need for an outlet. And then obviously in England, we get most of our fans, and Geraldine Davis is handling things over there, and she's doing a wonderful job. And we're just kind of online now and don't really go overboard trying to promote stuff. I'm pretty happy at the pace things are going. I don't live beyond my means. I just live a pretty happy life, man. If I got a little whiskey, little cigar, a couple other things I enjoy doing, and that's it, man. I got an old country beat up pickup truck, living like an old cowboy out here.
Do you have a favorite piece that you've ever done?
I don't have a favorite piece. I look back and I think it's my favorite, and then 2 months later it can change. I see pieces there. I think if anything, I get sentimentally attached to the time when it was done. So for example, Lewis and Tua, I remember painting that in the Poconos, like after training sessions and before dinner with the team. I paint for a little bit, and Emmanuel would come in every day and say, "Oh, this thing's looking great." And it was just that piece to me takes me back to a place in time and memories. And so it's not really the image, but it's just the fact of when and where it was done. I think that might be the most meaningful piece to me, because I was surrounded by nothing but friends, and it was just a big thing. Yeah.
How long does it take you to do a fight picture?
It's tough to say. My typical answer is, when people say, "How long did it take you to paint that?" I say 46 years, because that's how long it took me to learn the skills to take it, to do it. But the actual time from a blank canvas, depending on the size of the canvas and the subject, can be from, a week to a month.
Okay. I fully respect that answer, by the way. I know you smile sort of wryly with the 46 years thing, but because I get that, and I get what you're saying, because that's not what it's about, but yes. But my direct was obviously from the minute that you put the first drop of paint on the canvas to the last paint. But obviously you have answered that. I appreciate you humoring me with the original question.
I'm sure you feel the same with your words. It's like somebody say, "Hey, Tris, how long did it take you to write this amazing book?" Like however long it took, but it took you years to be able to get that format and that style. And that's where the art is at. It's not just the polishing and the final product. It's putting in all those hours and learning how to do stuff. That's where it really comes in. There's certain shortcuts and techniques you learn, and they come in handy.
Do you make mistakes?
Of course. I make more mistakes than I do anything else. They're just good mistakes. I turn a mistake. That's what makes the artwork recognizable and not photorealistic. I've tried the photorealistic stuff and I did pretty well at it, but I don't enjoy it. I don't really even enjoy seeing other people's super talented photorealistic pieces. I think artwork should have some character. I think there should be some drips, some splashes, something you can read into. I don't think it should look like a photograph. I think, you know, artwork has a place where, like I said, I have to always leave a little bit of a percentage for the viewer to fill in the gaps. It's almost, I guess you could say, writing a paragraph or something. You kind of ask a little bit of a question in the paragraph. I don't know much about the writing world, but sometimes it's good to provoke thought in people and instead of just give them the answer right away.
Yeah, but if I write a paragraph that looks like junk, I can hold down the delete button and get rid of it. If you made a few incorrect brush strokes, what do? Do you just bin the canvas or do you just go around it or what? How does that work?
Well, I got a pretty good cigar lighter, man. It's got butane gas and that. So it's not quite like the delete button, but it's about as quick. I'll torch it.
Can you tell me who some of your higher profile clients have been? Some guys that you've actually done artwork for? I'm not talking about networks or promoters, but I mean, you know, whether it's actors, fighters or whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot out there. And some do like to remain anonymous because I guess they figure me throwing their name out there is using them as an endorsement or something. And that's never been my angle and it never would. But guys that are openly supportive are guys like Eminem has a piece, Bruno Mars, Travis Tritt, who's a big country western singer over here. He collects. I mean, there's off the top of my head, Donald Trump got a piece when it was his birthday party, and Joe Frazier had to buy him a gift. So Joe said, "Hey, you know, can you do a painting for him?" So that's how the piece got in Trump's hand. And I think Madonna has a piece. Denzel Washington. You know, it's not really something I keep up with because
a job's a job.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be like me asking you to do any celebrities own your books, and I'm sure thousands do, and it's just like but you don't keep up with that.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't be quite so sure. But what about has anyone asked you to paint anything unusual, like way off script in terms of, you know, nothing to do with boxing?
There has been. There has been. And I just won't do it. If I feel like it's not part of me, it's like all the money in the world wouldn't get me paint something that I don't feel, you know. It's I have kind of at this point in my career got myself stuck into the boxing thing. I'm known as a boxing artist. The fine art world are like, well, you know, like you're a boxing artist, but I can paint other stuff. But yeah, I choose to be a boxing artist because that's it's a challenge. When Leroy Newman told me you could never make it as a boxing artist solely dealing with boxing, I thought, well, maybe you couldn't, but I'm going to give it the best I got. I don't need a Rolls Royce. I don't need to live above Central Park. If I can get by doing what I love, then and be able to turn down things I don't want to paint, that to me is success.
Was Leroy a hero of yours?
Yeah, he was actually. He certainly was a hero, or definitely an inspiration and a friend. He was always positive of things, and that's why he gave me advice, and maybe I should have listened, and my lifestyle would be tenfold what it is now or more. But instead of driving a old Ford pickup truck, I might be driving a Lamborghini. Yeah, he was always there for me, always supportive. We had very similar upbringings. He loved boxing. He'd go to the gym and I don't think he ever fought, but he would sketch guys in the gym. And obviously we met through Joe Frazier, which put him at ease right away. It wasn't like I was his competition or anything like that. He was just like, wow, Joe's finally got a guy that I can communicate with, somebody that we have something in common with.
Ever do any Ali or Tyson stuff, either about them or for them?
Yeah, absolutely. I did. I did a piece for Muhammad. I'd met Muhammad numerous occasions, and the last time was a Thanksgiving. I think 2 years
before. You were a crazy guy.
he did know I was a Fraser guy, but that's okay, because one of his son-in-laws, a good friend of mine, Mike Joyce, is also a Fraser guy, and you know, Ali used to give him a lot of shit about it, but you know, Mike didn't want to lie to the guy, and he always said, growing up, I was a Joe Frazier guy. And then he married one of the beautiful twins, Jamila, and Mike did, and they always rag on Mike about that. But, you know, as years went by, Ali spoke very highly of Joe at the funeral. Ali pretty much stood the whole time and clapped like you'd never imagine. I mean, there was tears rolling down his face, and he wasn't in great health when he attended Joe's funeral, which I was actually a pallbearer at. But I kept my eye on Ali because it was just a human interest thing. I was like, you know, I wonder how Ali's really going to react here. And I kind of wanted closure to see if, you know, he really loved Joe. And I believe he did. I believe he did. But yeah, I've done quite a lot of Ali. Maybe the first one was 1993. I had a sketch of Ali in my little portfolio that I carried around, and I showed him in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he said, "Man, you know, you're the greatest," and all this stuff. Like he went into his speech that he probably gives to everybody, but he really picked me up. And I went to Kinko's, and I had $21, and it was a color copy, was a dollar each. I made 21 prints. And I said, "Mr. Ali," I said, "you know, you can have these." I said, since you like it, I was like, "feel free to give it out to anybody in the hotel," or we were staying a couple of doors apart. Fraser and I in one suite, Ali in another. And he kept about four of them, and he signed the rest of them and slid them back under my door. He said, "You give them out to people you think would like them." And I thought that was the coolest thing. So somewhere out there is, you know, 16 or 17 hand signed, actually 21, he kept a few of them, but 16 or 17 that I gave away, and you know, probably worth a fortune now.
I'm gonna say, you would have made more than $21 if you'd hung on to them.
Yeah, exactly. But the memory is priceless, and that was a trip where it was Ali, Fraser, and I in the back of the limo together, and at that time Joe was pretty pissed off with him, and it was it's quite an awkward ride, but Ali was, you know, and he was very nice to me. And then I went to Joe and I said, "Joe," I said, "I think this guy's actually okay, man. Maybe you should give him a second chance." And Joe was like, "Oh, he's got you bullshitted too." He was like, "Yeah, that's what he does." He was like, he's you know, that's why they call him the lip, man. He can bullshit his way into anything. And I said, "I better stay out of the middle of this one."
Have you ever seen one of your pictures up in lights in Vegas?
Yeah. It was actually highlighted a number of times. Mandalay Bay used it on their big billboard downtown when Mayweather fought Pacquiao. There was a huge, I don't know, 40 by 80 foot like vinyl banner promoting the fight. So yeah, it's quite neat to see that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you're a long way from Cumbria when you see that sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. I still miss Cumbria, and I miss that lifestyle, and you know, obviously I miss my family over there. I'm the only guy over here. I have a 16-year-old daughter, but that's my only blood in this country, and I chose this life, and it hasn't been easy. But it's been fun, and it's still fun, and I guess it's better than shoveling cow shit in Cumbria, which is probably what I'd be doing.
Do you worry about the future and that graphic design is going to take over everything eventually?
No, not at all. I think, like I said, art is something that you know, shouldn't be perfect. And even though they have programs that can manipulate imperfections, it is the imperfection and the story that or the emotion that it can evoke. And I think it can only be done by a fine artist. And whether that fine artist is using a brush or a computer, if they can, you know, still bring that emotion out, then you know, technology will enhance art. But you know, the traditional side of it will never go away.
What haven't you painted that you really must paint? Or whom haven't you painted that you really need to paint?
That's a great question. I don't really know. It's like there's lots of... I wanted to paint a bullfight. I kind of figured that's kind of a boxing kind of thing. It's something that's kind of up my alley. Like, even though I don't really support the cruelty to the animal, but I think a bullfight has all the drama and the elements of a prize fight, and I think it's more socially acceptable to or more commercially acceptable to hang in somebody's living room as opposed to, you know, a picture of Manny Pacquiao or a picture of Joe Frazier or whoever it may be. I think a bullfight would make for a better commercial piece, but also fulfill my desire to put those emotions of a fight in there. You know, you've got the matador who's
getting out. Never been to one.
Never been to one. I've seen them. I mean, I've watched YouTubes and I've read books but just the colors that they wear, the matadors and the ferocity and the power of the bull, I think it would make a wonderful painting.
Okay, I've got some questions from some of my guys on Patreon, if I can stick them to you.
Sure.
Ryan Nate says, if you could paint any fighter from past eras, who would it be and why? Do you do many retro ones like that, like your Jack Dempsey's or your Jack Johnson's or guys like that?
Yeah. I do once in a while. I've done stuff when Willie Pep was alive. I did Willie Pep, Sandy Sadler, Bo Jack, but these are all guys that I got to have conversations with, and Ike Williams, you know, obviously Joe Louis and Marciano were gone before my time, but I did paint those. I am a big Jack Dempsey fan, a big Harry Greb fan, Stanley Ketchel. So eventually I'll probably get to them all in the end. I mean they all have a story and they all have they'll all make for great paintings. I mean just the character of the guys, that's what I like to capture, the character. So if the more of a character they were, the more chance that I'll paint them.
Good one here from Edward Sturzaker, who asks, I'd like to know if Richard ever considered becoming a trainer after being around so many boxing greats for so long.
That is a great question, and it's actually something I have considered, and I've worked many, many corners, and I think between my knowledge of, you know, 10 years with Frazier and as his right-hand man, and 10 years with Emmanuel as his right-hand man, I think there's definitely a few tricks, you know, being around the Lennox Lewises and the high-class champions. It's something I think... at some point I will get into.
Yeah. Liam Tyre asks, ask why you gave up fighting, which you've touched upon, and what inspired you to start painting. Yeah, I mean, what was the spark? Was it just something that you did in a class once and enjoyed it?
Yeah, well, actually I was a pretty bad kid, and they even my mother would say, hey, you know, go sit in the corner, man. Take a pencil and paper and come out when you can behave. So I'd go there and I'd be there for 4 hours, you know. And she's like, okay, it's time now. You've done your time. I'm like, no, I'm not finishing my drawing. So yeah, it's just something that's always been in me. My mother says, you know, from an early age, you know, I was in a pram, you know, with a crayon and it's just always drawing. You know, she laughs now. She doesn't know much about boxing, but she remembers the early days where I just draw anything. If there was a leaf laying on the ground, I'd do a drawing of it.
Was there anything that you really practiced, by the way, like over and over, like say a leaf? Was there something that you really sort of honed your craft on, or a dog, or whatever?
Not really. I struggle a little bit with hands. And that's something I do want to practice, but I've never practiced one particular area.
Oh my God, that's what you wound up with boxing, because you just do gloves.
Exactly.
Your whole career is based on your inability to do hands.
Exactly, Tris. You've cracked the code, man. You've cracked the code. So, seriously. I mean, and maybe the fact that I haven't painted so many hands because they've always been gloved or wrapped. You know, maybe that's why I don't excel in hands. It's actually an interesting point.
Yeah. Mandizzle asks, what's the most unusual thing you've noticed about painting fighters that you don't see with regular people?
I think it's, you know, from being a former fighter myself and being around fighters, I think you have to capture that determination in their eyes. And it really only comes from my knowledge in fighters. I'm sure other athletes have it too. Anybody that's elite at their professions, even business guys, but I think it's never more raw than in boxing. I think if you can capture that emotion and just that little glint in their eye and that little biting down on the mouthpiece a little bit more, like that's what I love to capture.
Craig Brookfield, good one here. I've read about him calling out boxing figures in America on the phone when you were younger. Who was the most friendly? Did anyone refuse to speak to you? And who was responsible for the biggest phone bill?
Marvin Hagler was responsible for the biggest phone bill. I got to know everybody in Marvin's family. At the time, he had a store in Hanover, Massachusetts, called Marvelous Enterprises. And I became the English rep to sell his goods. But I was 14 years old. I had no advertising budget, no business knowledge. Yeah, exactly. So I used to write the boxing news and write about something and put it in the bottom, I'd say. And by the way, I represent, I have Marvin Hagler gear available if anybody wants to contact me. This was back when they'd publish your actual address. So people would write. Yeah. I'd send them a hand-typed price list. And so Hagler was the biggest bill. Jake LaMotta, I got real friendly with. One time, I tried to put my friend on the phone with him. It was a huge, I mean, me and Jake, we got along really well. And I tried to put my buddy James on the phone. It was James's dream to speak to Jake LaMotta. And I said, Jake, would you, say hello to my friend James? And he didn't answer. And I handed the phone to James. And James said, hello, Mr. LaMotta. And Jake just said, wrong number, and hung up.
Oh, wow. I've got a very similar story. So, when I travel around America interviewing fighters, I phoned Jake when I was in Manhattan once, and I said, oh, hi, Mr. LaMotta. I'm an English kid, and I'm traveling around America speaking to old fighters. Can I come and interview you? And he said, how much money you got? And I said, oh, geez, Mr. LaMotta, I don't have much money. He said, well, kid, if you haven't got the money, you haven't got the money, and hung up. And I went and interviewed Jose Torres instead.
Yeah. No, but Jake was wonderful, and I got to be real friendly with with Jake Jr., who lived just outside of Philadelphia, and then one of Jake's other kids. Well, Jake Jr. has passed away now, and he passed away before Jake did, and the other guy, he lost in the I think it was Joey, his brother's namesake. Yeah. He went down in one of those airline terrorist attacks or whatever it was in New York. So, yeah, Jake lost a lot of his boys and kept going till 96 and was still real sharp.
Yeah.
Still real sharp.
Glenn Wilson asks, what's Richard's favorite boxing painting by any artist and why?
I think the Dempsey Furpo by George Bellows. I think that's probably my favorite because it just shows the guys getting knocked through the ropes and the expressions on the people's faces. It's a real storyteller. Whereas most of my paintings are done pre-fight and they're done for commercial reasons. So a lot of them have to kind of be even. You can't show somebody being knocked through the ropes and a woman crying in the background. But some of these old paintings, they really tell stories, and that's unfortunately with mine being needed for commercial purposes, the storytelling is not really something I'm allowed to do.
His second part to that, by the way, is also how influential was Hall of Famer Leroy Neiman, an icon in boxing art, to you?
He was massive. Even though there was boxing artists before him that actually, an auction and stuff go for five times Leroy's prices, Leroy was the guy that got out there with his mustache and his cigar and his white suit, and he played the game. I mean, he was in Rocky. Yeah. Oh, yeah, he changed the game, but played the game of being a personality and would always carry his sketchbook with him, even if he wasn't sketching. He opened so many doors. It's it's the comparisons I get all the time. If I say I'm a boxing artist, the first thing somebody says is, "Oh, so you kind of like Leroy Neiman." It's like he's definitely a household name, very inspirational, was very kind to me, and somebody I'll certainly never forget.
I love this question. Last one is from Jamie Ingleby. Has any fighter ever taken offense with the way they've looked in your artwork?
That's a great question. It is. Not that I know of. There's been some hidden things that I've put in certain fighters that if they found, because like I said, I paint the characters, and if I know them, if there's certain things that I've hidden in paintings, I don't think they've found them yet, but...
You make the picture sound like a magic eye where you got to look at them a certain way to find
it is, man.
They're
like, you know, I don't know if they have them over there in England anymore, but Find Waldo is a big thing over here in America, where you've got to look at the picture for a long time to find this little guy, and the paintings are actually like that. If you really,
yeah, we got Where's that, Wally?
Where's Wally? Maybe that's what it is. Okay, well, Find Waldo, Where's Wally? So yeah, it's they're kind of like that. And not all of them have it, which is pretty frustrating if you're trying to find something. but, you know, most of them do.
Let me paraphrase the second part of his question. Is there a major fight that you didn't do the artwork for that you wish you'd done it for?
No, actually not. I almost passed on the... recently, I almost passed on the... fantasy matchup of Mike Tyson and Tyson Fury, but he's had such great feedback. I just, you know, I'm not really big into the fantasy match stuff because, I don't get into conversations of who would have won, you know, Sugar Ray Robinson or Marvin Hagler. It's like, you know, to me, you could talk till you're blue in the face. So it's kind of a reverse question. Reverse answer, the one I did paint that I wasn't going to was Tyson versus Tyson. And I turned out to be very, very well received. And I was very happy I did that.
That one.
Yeah, it was on Ring Magazine. And we're actually doing a limited edition canvas that's signed by both fighters. So the prints are actually in Morecambe right now. So they should be back next week.
Brilliant. Yeah. Okay. Well, Richard, I'm really pleased that we finally got to do this, and hopefully our paths will be crossing more if we do this, if we manage to get this Kronk book up and running.
Absolutely, man. And if you're in Vegas...
I'll tap you up the artwork for the cover.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Anything you want, Tristan. If you're ever in Vegas, man, Mikasa Sukasa, man. You always got a place here, and you always got a friend here, man.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time, man. It's been a great ride, and I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Trace. All the best, and we will speak soon, my friend. Thank you very much to all the listeners and all the viewers, and you know, I really appreciate the support, guys. You guys, you've fulfilled the dreams in my life by supporting something that people said could never be done. So, to all the listeners, thank you very much.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Speak to you soon.
Thanks, Trace. Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Great stuff from Richard there. As he alluded to there, he is represented by the brilliant Geraldine Davies over here in the UK. Geraldine, you can find on social media. And obviously, there's an archive episode with Geraldine where I interviewed her about her time in boxing. That was actually just before lockdown. If you haven't listened to that, by all means, go back and check it out. A reminder, this podcast is brought to you by Hanson Lee Resourcing and Delco Safety Compliance. Delco Safety Compliance are a leading provider of professional fire asbestos and safety services to businesses nationwide. They offer one expert point of contact for all of your fire, health and safety compliance needs. And you can find out more at delcosafety.co.uk. Hanson Lee Resourcing were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the 2020 Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, but Hanson Lee will help you retain them, and you can find out more about them at hansonlee.com. Just one more time, guys, if you haven't checked out my Patreon page, by all means go across. It's at patreon.com/TrisDixon. And as I said before, there's behind the scenes access into boxing life stories. There's polls. I'm asking people over there to get involved with who they'd like to see as future guests. There's more podcasts going up there all the time. Not taking the podcast behind a paywall, but those guys do get a lot of extra content. for their subscription. There are subscriptions from £5 all the way up to £20, depending on the level of support you'd like to give the podcast. And by all means, go and check it out. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much to Richard Sloan. If you could rate and review this podcast on iTunes, that would be hugely appreciated. Always grateful for you guys listening and tuning in. Thank you so much, and I'll be back next week.